Hey everybody, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome my friend Oz Sultan to the show. I've known Oz all the way since 2008 when we were going to these Bill Sobel breakfasts around Columbus Circle. And Oz is a technologist and a strategist who's been active in the tech world both as a CTO, Chief Technological Officer, and in marketing, designing multi-million dollar and startup tech companies, and very active in the blockchain space, as well as one thing that really interests me, which is social media counterterrorism. So I really want to talk about that in further detail. So Oz, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for joining us. Lev shared with me your article in Town Hall, which was really, I thought, really eloquent. And I'm going to share it on my Facebook wall after this talk. But I also watched some of your videos and stuff that were hyperlinked in the article. And I'm really glad that there's people in the community elevating these dialogues, because I feel like there's so much confusion all the time, and like de-radicalization is so important.
It's not just, de-radicalization is important, when we talk about terrorists like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But, what we're finding now, and this I think is becoming increasingly more important, is that I raised the issue of the laughing man, who I think is the new next generation terrorist, right? And this is on the one side, Antifa, on the other side, it's white supremacists. I use the terms, AR slash WS, which is alt-right white supremacist, and LE slash Antifa, which is left extremist slash Antifa. And what's really kind of interesting is that we're not only getting, sort of the same reactions from both groups, but El Paso and Dayton have kind of crystallized that this is almost the same issue. We've got both groups going online. We've got both groups getting weaponized, and we've got both groups going and trying to figure out what they can do to lash out. And that lashing out is now resulting in mass casualties.
It's terrifying, really. It's really terrifying. And I understand all these conversations that come up about gun control. And it's sometimes it seems like in America, we're in the Wild West over here, and we have Pandora's box is like opening one after another. Like we'll be talking about gun control on one hand, and then you have 3D printers nobody wants to talk about, or you have people can produce these ghost guns. And they can't even regulate the 3D printers yet. Nobody wants to talk about it. But I think gun control at this point is moot. But that can be a tangent. But it is really scary when you think about what the human mind can do and all the ways we're vulnerable to different
You
ideas.
would have raised, I raised the issue of two things. I live in New York City. I think, Lev, you're here too. New York has the most strict gun laws in the United States, and I'm a district leader in Harlem, and we have at least two shootings a week. Now, what no one talks about is that you can have all of these strict gun laws. And I'm in District 5, right, which is, one of the poorest school districts in New York City. Kids have told me, like when I go and speak in the schools, that for about $50, any one of them can access a gun. If anyone wants a rifle, it's maybe about $200. And if you want an assault rifle, it's probably a couple $100, right? So all of this stuff is available in the black market. And these types of shootings happen on an ongoing basis in between Harlem, going into Queens, going into the Bronx. If you think back to last year, or not even last year, it was earlier this year, we had MS-13 murder a teenager on the 7 train going into Queens, right? So these types of things get local coverage, but they don't get national coverage. And the only national coverage we ever get is something along the lines of like, oh my God, someone used an AR-15. And then you have like Kamala Harris saying, I will stop the importation of all AR-15s. And I'm like, well, the AR-15 is manufactured in the United States. The only thing that's manufactured outside of the U.S. are like kind of replacement receivers. So what are you going to do? Block like the importation of part of a gun? Our politicians aren't educated on this. The gun control advocates absolutely ignore the problems that we have in big cities. And I think a lot of this is like people would want to put some giant Band-Aid on it and be like, look, we did great thing. But the only thing that solves this is community engagement, you know, and people are more afraid of talking to their neighbors. They're more focused on Instafame, as I said in that article, than they are on actually solving the actual solution. And these Band-Aids are going to do nothing.
Well, you were talking before about the difference between the Muslim community in the United States versus Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to generalize here, but European cities are fairly ghettoized when it comes to where Muslim people live. And as far as the amount of welfare that they get, it almost seems like it is by design for them not to enculturate more into the European economy, for them to just live separately away from everybody else. And from, I mean, even though they have gun-free zones all over Europe, we've been seeing a lot of knife attacks. We've been seeing a lot of robberies. We've been seeing general chaos, and people in Europe, whether it's crime like that or the rape gangs in Rotherham, England, are not that fond of talking about it. They almost want to sweep it under the rug. So what do you think is the primary reasons why they're so different?
Well, so first of all, the American Muslim population comes from 77 different countries and is about 100 different ethnicities and maybe about 120 different languages. Okay. And of that community, most of us were now, like, I'm first generation, like my parents were immigrants, but there's a lot of American Muslims who are like third, fourth generation now, right? And so everyone's grown up in America, everyone's inculcated into America. American Muslims have four different factors that make them different. One, they're better educated. Okay, so on average, they have at least a bachelor's degree, in many cases an advanced degree. Two, per capita, they earn more. So the per capita income, I think per capita in this country is about 30, I may be wrong on this, somewhere between 34,000 and 43,000. Per capita for Muslims is closer to 80,000. The third part is that they're civically engaged. Whether you like, you know, I mean, I'm on the Republican side of the aisle, Ilhan Omar is on the Democrat side of the aisle, and you've got two elected Republican representatives who are Muslim inside of Congress that get absolutely no press coverage. You know, but we're involved in politics. We're involved in our communities. We have built our local mosques. We've focused on interfaith. And after 9/11, you know, after 9/11, we were forced to confront terrorism head on. And what most of our communities did, in terms of our communities have joined law enforcement, they're members of, you know, there's 1,000 Muslim cops inside of the NYPD, all the way to the rank of chief today. And we actually worked to root out the problems in our communities. And if anyone is to be looked at in terms of like, what is the model for fixing this in America, it's the Muslim community. Why? Because we had to, you know, we had to band together. You look at two of the kids that were caught for terrorism inside of the past couple of years in New Jersey, their own parents had reported them to the FBI. Okay. So that's the level of what we have here. Now let's take a crowbar and separate that from European Muslims. So British Muslims are Indian and Pakistani. All right. Pan-European Muslims, so we'll call them, continental European Muslims. The ones in France are typically Central African. Why? Because up until the 1960s, the French people in France called all of Central Africa France. And it wasn't until the absolute horrors of the French people in Angola, Soweto, and a couple of other countries where they literally like massacred people and created the first levels of guerrilla warfare that turned into terrorist guerrilla warfare, you know, that we ended up having like real problems of migrations back to France, because what the French did was they said, okay, we're going to pull sticks. We're going to tax you guys. We're going to make you put your money in our banks, but you'll have the right of return. And they didn't think anyone would come to France. And so when all these people did come to France, when you had all of these Africans coming to France and settling there, it's not like coming to America. You can become Muslim. You come to America, you're Muslim. You know, after about a generation, you're freaking American. They will always be African. They could be third generation French speakers, and they will never be considered French. We have the same problem in Germany, right? So you've got Turks there. Then, you know, when you start going across most of the rest of Europe, you've got Syrians and all these other folks. And so there's two problems there. In Britain, most of the Indians and Pakistanis that go there are not educated. A lot of them are villagers, and then a lot of them end up stuck in ghettos where the opportunities are basically you graduated high school, so you can work in your bodega or, you know, your local corner store that your dad owns. You can work inside of a restaurant, or you can join a gang, right? And what that has led to is sex grooming gangs that are run by Pakistanis. I want to separate these people from regular Muslims. Okay, let's talk about who they are and what the problem is. You've got Indian gangs that are over there that are involved in mafia style crimes. And yeah, these people are Muslims, but they're very different Muslims than I am.
Let me address, for example, child marriage. Okay, the idea of childhood is actually a modern concept. It's something that if you look at the anthropology of childhood, anthropologists will note that the idea of childhood is something that's very new, only less than 200 years old. And the idea is that when you have a kinship-based society and you have a certain lifespan, then children are expected to be contributing to the family. They're expected to contribute to society and to their community. Because there's not a career that they're pursuing. There's not a need for a technical education that extends for 12, 14, 16 years.
Let me interrupt. Yeah. So you think that having sex with a 9-year-old is justified?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that the... So here, let me ask you a question. Okay, is the problem with I have to frame it. Okay, so if you have, do you have a problem with child marriage because you think it is categorically wrong, or is it because it's conditionally wrong?
They're ethnically different than me. They're culturally different than me, and they're also British Muslims who, at the same time, are saying they're not British, they're Indian, or they're Pakistani. And you're running into these same problems inside of France. Inside of France, France has spent more time relegating people to some of the outside districts outside of Paris. So instead of counties in France, everything is called a district, and the entire country is administered as different districts. So they relegated a lot of the Black Muslims to these poor areas, no transportation, no job opportunities. So you basically created a ghetto, right? In Germany, what the Turkish did was they actually took the incentive and they kind of created things for themselves. So like you can go to Dubai now and there's a place inside it's not the Emirates Mall, it's the big mall, that is Turkish doner kebab, right? It's German style Turkish doner kebab. That's what it was. So I mean, what the Turks have done is they've married into the culture there. They've made themselves part of it. The Syrians are starting to do it, but you know, again, they've only been there for like a couple of years. And then the last piece of this, which is more problematic, is a lot of the Syrians that ended up there were trained, like, you know, they were doctors, lawyers, this and that. But the intake systems by most of these countries by which they're taking in refugees is not equipped to put them and train them linguistically to go and get the jobs that they're qualified for. Then we run into things like their credentials aren't accepted in this country. So, you know, it's like the Ukrainian physicist that came to America and as a janitor, you got those types of problems. And then lastly, I would say Angela Merkel, right? I think her the biggest German chancellor failure in the past 100 years, and everyone's making the joke like, well, Hitler was a bigger failure. But, you know, if you think about democratically elected ones, yeah, she's pretty bad, because what she did is she's doing the same thing that we're doing with our migrant camps, but she's doing them in cities. She's paying people somewhere between like $900 and a couple $1,000 a month per person that they house. But what they're doing is they're taking a room, you know, that's kind of like this little editing suite that I'm in right now, and they're putting a bunch of bunk beds in there, and they're charging the state, you know, what, $900, $1,000 a month per person. And they're in a room like this, they might be making $10,000, $15,000. And so, you know, that those are the kind of problems that you're dealing with. It's just the European experiment failed.
Can you clarify what the European experiment was with Merkel? is it
the European experiment was that we can bring all these refugees in, that we don't necessarily have to have a cohesive strategy by which we bring these refugees in, that they should just be fine. And you got to think about this anyway. If you bring someone to your country, you got to teach them your cultures and customs. You know, one of the biggest problems that I've heard with like exchange students here, and this is just historically going back, is like you get a kid from France, he's not going to bathe, so you might want to buy him some deodorant. It's true. You're all laughing. You know, but it's
by the way, that applies to Russians.
You're like, hey, you know, we water's not and then it's just like tell people to bathe, tell people that you know you use utensils all the time.
Well, this is like with Peter the Great when he was reforming the Russian people. He cut off the sleeves of the nobility. He shaved the beards off. He did all kinds of things in order to enculturate Russia into a European mold. And I've been recently researching about Muslim modernists or reformists. I'm not really sure what the right term is. I think it's modernists. People like Syed Ahman Khan and Muhammad Abdu, people who were... in the intellectual elite, you could say, who were talking about keeping things like the five pillars of Islam, while at the same time not necessarily subscribing to all the family law, to all aspects of Sharia law. Do you find that quality?
So let me walk you through that one. So one, I think the term modernist shouldn't be used. And I think postmodernist is a more dangerous term because this is what we're getting largely from, I think, a lot of liberal elite when they talk about Muslims. The number of conversations that I've had on Twitter where someone tells me that this is what Muslims are. I'm like, really? Please tell me more about what I'm supposed to be. And this is a consistent problem because, and it happens with Muslims, it happens with Blacks, it happens with Latinos, I mean, it happens with Russians. You know, they're like, oh, shouldn't you be eating borscht and living in Brighton Beach? Why are you in Manhattan? You know, and it's this kind of like cynical, you know, just lazy racism. And stereotyping of people that has created the biggest problem. So I take for when Islam is considered, take the term modernist, throw it out the window. Take the term postmodernist, throw it out the window, because it opens a lot of Pandora's box issues. What we have is we have reformers, okay? And there are reformers that we're talking about. How do you balance the needs of the West and the needs of the East? But what I will say is that we're really moving more towards a revival. And the revival is that like, look, you can be practicing very much like Orthodox Jews are practicing and very nice members of society. Okay, I'm practicing, right? There's a lot of my friends that are practicing. We don't have any beef. We don't have any issues. But the challenge is that the expectations of what people understand of the religion and you know, the fear factor of what they're dealing with. Like we're literally in the same place we were in the 1920s, when the KKK was running candidates on a Democrat platform and had people like Hugo Black, right? But what were they running at that time? They were running a complete anti-Catholic platform. Today, what we've got from a little bit of the right and a little bit of the left is an anti-Muslim platform because we're new, we're scary, our religion is scary, the same way that the bishops were scary. So I'll unpack Islam a little bit. Everyone talks about, well, what about Sharia law? And I'm like, first of all, it's not Sharia law. It's fiqh, okay, which is spelled F-I-Q-H, and that's Islamic jurisprudence. That's the overarching sort of thing that is the codex by which we start putting a lot of different pieces together. So underneath that, there's madhabs, which are schools of thought. So inside of Sunni Islam, you have different schools of thought, which are, there's five major ones. There's Hanafi, Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanbali, and Ismaili. And I'm Hanafi, okay, which is kind of, but I've also got Hanbali people in the family. And I'm not going to go into this diatribe because I really don't want to eat up your entire podcast by explaining Islam. But in the opposite side of this, what we have is we have Sharia. Now, Sharia means a couple different things. The concept for most Muslims is how I get married, okay? And that involves something called a mahar, which is our equivalent of a dowry, but in Islam, the man brings the money. The dowry comes with the man. So if I were to go and ask someone to get married, I have to bring the money to basically set up the marital household. The second thing is the slaughter of my meat, okay? Halal slaughter of meat, that falls under Sharia law. And the third is how I finance my house and inheritance laws. Outside of those four things, Sharia has absolutely no bearing in the West and shouldn't have any bearing in the West. However, there's the other side of this, which is the Islamic law. Sharia laws are codified inside of different cultures and different countries, where that is part and parcel of how their democratic republic or their monarchy is set up. And that's what people are afraid of coming over here. And I'm like, well, who's bringing it? And they're like, well, there's some guy in Texas talking about it. I'm like, is that guy on a PTA board? No, but he's saying it. I'm like, does that guy have a pack or a block of voters behind him? They're like, no, but he's saying it. And you can go to his office. And I'm like, the guy's an idiot. You know, I'm like, and I don't understand why the only people that we put on television these days are idiots. People who want to talk about Sharia law, people who are terrorists. You know, I'll tell you what, CNN and MSNBC will never put me on because I'm a conservative and I'm an American Muslim, and they probably don't like what I have to say. But what they will put on is they'll put a whole bunch of people who are sympathetic to saying whatever the hell they want to hear on air. And that is really the biggest problem we have. Muslims have a PR and an advertising problem, but in America, we're pretty kind of cohesive and organized and building towards the next generation of things. And, you know, I've worked on interfaith for probably about a decade. I mean, we've talked about this stuff, and I'm working on a new project called Our House now, which is, you know, trying to put together a interfaith house of worship that will have a Christian church, a Jewish synagogue, and a Muslim prayer space in it. And the goal is that how can we get Generation Z and younger kids to start talking to each other, not just about religion, but about the issues that we don't talk about. I mean, like, in between Jews and Muslims, we've always had interfaith. But in between Christians and Muslims, we've had like zero interfaith. And there's a big need to open this stuff up now.
That's really cool. I had a brief question. Why are you a conservative or a part of the GOP? For people that are non-political or people who see you as an anomaly, or because if you're like outside of the mainstream narrative, like how would you contextualize that? Like,
so this goes back to the 80s. So when I was in junior high school, there was a bunch of us that formed a local Republican club, and it's because of a couple of things. One is states' rights. Two is fiscal conservancy. But you have to remember, I grew up with communism, okay? Like, when I was growing up, there was still a Cold War. And this was something that we were worried about. So in the late 1980s, we were still, like, we still had nuclear bomb drills, okay? And this was, like, when I was getting into high school, you know, because I graduated in 91, 92. And so, you know, we still had nuclear bomb drills. We still had those kinds of things. We still had air raid sirens. We still had the belt system that people talked about. And if you're not familiar with that, if you're ever driving somewhere and you see blue belt, orange belt, green belt, there's a color-coded system by which, if in the case there's a nuclear attack, you drive towards the, I think it's the darkest color belt, which takes you the furthest away from where that nuclear bomb blast could be. Mm-hmm. And these were the types of things that, you know, these were our realities. War was a reality. You know, I grew up with a number of I had a comic shop in the 1990s, and the guy that we rented the space from was a Vietnam vet who had a hook for a hand, right? And, you know, this was the reality of America that you lived in. Like, you understood these things. And so what happened after Gulf War I, which, by the way, like, I had my uncle in Kuwait, and my dad, and this guy was a guy that was like kind of the black sheep in the family. We sort of shunned him, but my dad hadn't talked to him in, I think, like 30 years. And when Saddam invaded Kuwait, you know, we lost, like, he lost everything. And they had to pack up everything in a station, how to get together and send some money, you know. And this is kind of like the consistent issue that we have with war and Muslims. But the thing to kind of think about is that war was televised, okay? We saw the bodies coming home. And the thing that has always stuck with me is sort of three things about my republicanism. One is I've always been very states' rights. Regardless of the state that you're in, that state has the right to make its own rules. People don't like what New York's rules are in terms of, you know, gun restrictions or abortion rights or this or that. You know, they can go jump off of a cliff. Pennsylvania has its own right to make its own decision. You know, California has its own right to make its own decision. I don't necessarily support a lot of things Governor Cuomo does, but I support the state's rights ability to do it. Two is the fiscal conservancy. And, you know, it's, I'm just, we need less spending. We need to cut back on things. And that's been a big thing. But three is really the foreign policy pieces of this. You know, Reagan got us into a war, and that was Charlie Wilson's war. And I'll talk about that more in a minute, because I'm actually working with Joanne Herring right now on a migrant strategy that I can tell you guys about. But I've always looked at it this way. The people who've gotten us into the worst wars are people like Clinton, and going back, people like JFK and LBJ, you know, because those are the guys that really kind of scaled up Vietnam. I mean, Clinton was the one that got us into the Middle East war in a very, very gigantic way. And, you know, Secretary Clinton, who is his wife, who ran Hillary, destabilized Libya, which, you know, by taking out Gaddafi, and then was in the process of, you know, just not supporting Syria and a bunch of other things. So from my perspective as an American Muslim, what I have seen more often than not is that there's a lot of Democrats in power that once they get in power, they say a lot of nice things to our people, okay? But then they go and they F up a bunch of countries that are that Muslims live in. And what that does is it's just, it creates this sort of debilitating long-term consequence of refugees everywhere. When realistically, what we should be doing is we should be working on building success. And so
you know, part of it was, I'll just put it to you this way. I worked with Steve Bannon to try and get Trump to go over to the Middle East and basically have a conversation about Palestine. And when I first met the guy, he had invited a bunch of, you know, local Republican leaders to come and talk about our issues. And I've never had any politician take our issues seriously. And like, look, when I was living in Pittsburgh, because I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and I've been a New Yorker for about 16 years, you know, I knew the mayor, Tom Murphy, and I was friends with the county commissioner, Jim Roddy, and I worked on Jim Roddy's campaign, and I worked on Tom Ridge, the governor's campaign, you know, who later became a director of Homeland. And then I had worked on a variety of campaigns inside of the OOs, and, you know, then I ended up on Trump's campaign. And I got involved locally in politics because we had local Democrats taking money to try and rename Harlem Soha. Okay. Yeah. Well, because, you know, Soha is like super safe and you can move to Soha and, you know, like everyone's okay in Soha. But, you know, it's those types of things. Like the things that get me the most is that when I've worked with Democrats over the course of years, they'll say a lot of stuff, but they don't deliver on it. And when I've worked with Republicans over the course of years, they'll say things and they'll deliver on it. You know, the Democrats are a lot more organized. But, you know, it's just the patronizing of my religion. I mean, just go through my Twitter feed. John Neffinger, who's this big DNC strategist, was telling me I was a bad Muslim and I was irrepresentative of my religion because I was asking Ilhan Omar for her views on FGM. So I'm like, if I ask questions, you know, I get my religion discounted. If I express views they don't like, I get called a coon. If I've got called a sand N-word more than one time, and it's literally by liberals. And honestly, it's like that kind of, you know, double standard attitude where it's like, if you won't be what I want you to be, then I can't accept you. I just can't tolerate that. And I think what we're seeing a lot amongst Blacks and Hispanics, and, you know, 31% of Muslims voted for Trump, but like 80% of Muslims voted for Bush twice. And people are like, well, why did Muslims walk away from the Republican Party? It's real simple. When Bush was in that aircraft carrier and started invoking God, they were like, we saw this story in Egypt. We saw this story overseas before. We're walking away from that. And, you know, they gave the Dems a chance. But I think right now we're in a very strange space because, you know, you've got a lot of people who are on the fence about both parties. And all of this stuff, like calling everyone racist for everything. I mean, what is this? Like, I got called racist the other day by some white guy, and I was like, because I have a view you don't like? I'm like, you don't get to say that. I'm like, you don't have to deal with the same things I have to deal with on a regular basis. You don't have people calling you terrorist, you know? I'm like, yeah, where's this coming?
It's so preposterous. It does seem like it's manufactured somehow from some kind of, the expression is like, the tail wags the dog. Or something, mm-hmm. like certain talking points are introduced, and then just through parroting effects and echoing effects, they just kind of, you know, flippantly get introduced into conversations where people don't really have to think much about the rhetoric they're spewing. It's just sort of like whatever they can say, maybe to push someone's buttons or get under someone's skin or to like back up their team, so to speak. If you're really thinking in that blue-red mindset, you're not really thinking in the like localist, like let's solve problems. Like it doesn't like mindset.
No, which is where I live. You know, I live and I work in Harlem. I work in Midtown as well. But, you know, one of the things I'm looking at is like, how can we bring jobs in? How can we bring education in? This is why, you know, I ended up named a principal investigator to the Council Exchange Board of Trade. We're working on figuring out how we can leverage opportunity zones in Harlem. We're working on all these like things. And the president has signed 21 executive orders funding this stuff. At the same point in time, we've had global troop drawdowns. We're basically allowing Russia to, you know, spend themselves to death in Syria. We're doing kind of the same thing with China. We're trying to set things right. But, you know, there's what's actually going on and what you see and what I hear from the conversations I have, and I see like the successes. And there's this media narrative, but I'll give you just a case in point. I had to mute these two girls yesterday, but it's in my tweet feed. I just told them I disagreed with them. And it turned into personal attacks. It turned into personal attacks. And then this one girl was like, the button on your website's not working. You're not real. You're a troll. And I was like, I beg to differ. Why don't you just Google me? You'll find about 10 hours worth of video and about 100 articles I've written. But I mean, it's this kind of rhetoric. It's like disinform, devalue, debase, and deny. You know, and I just, this is consistently what we're getting. And then you have all of these people screaming about white supremacy and hate, but they're the ones that are giving the hate. And
I have a question. Are you familiar with Mark Stein?
He's an
occasional Fox News contributor. Like, I know he's been on Tucker Carlson. He wrote a book called America Alone. And he also wrote a book called After America, and I haven't read his books, but he's can be like kind of like an Ann Coulter writer, maybe. And I know he's banned from entering a number of Muslim countries. And so I think maybe one of his books could be called Alarmist. He was talking about demographic trends.
Is this the guy who's talking about how Europe is not going to be European because of Muslim births? Is that guy?
It could be that guy.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, but like, you know, New York has gone from hot dogs to halal guys. I mean, this stuff changes, you know. We have population demographic changes that have happened all over the time. We didn't have Jews all over the place. Now you have Jews all over the place. And I don't see anyone who's turning down a bottle or I was going to say a bottle of Manischewitz, but everyone who turns down a bottle of Manischewitz. I don't see anyone who's turning down chicken noodle soup or Kugel or, you know, or brisket, right? Who's turning down brisket?
Well, food is definitely one thing, but if we're talking about things that people value, talking with Muslim people here in New York, I think one of the things that we can learn from them is how much they value family, which I also tremendously value in my own life.
Absolutely.
Nowhere, if not for my mom and dad and the closeness that they feel to each other. But on the other side is the fear, which I think, where do Muslims, if you could take a poll of all the Muslims in New York or the United States, where would they stand on the phrase, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, render unto God what is God's, as far as the separation of church and state goes?
Most of them wouldn't understand what you just said. And I would tell you that most millennials wouldn't understand what you said. So it's a phrase that was originally in Latin, which was that you are giving the state what is the state's, and you're giving the church what is the church's. And I will tell you that most Muslims have come from countries where they have seen challenges. Like my father, I'm a weirdo, okay, because my father's Saudi and my mother's Mughal, which is technically Indo-Persian, but it's a little bit more specific than that. It was the Nizams of Hyderabad. It's a long story. So anyway, and my parents met the traditional way, arranged marriage. that kind of being what it is. My dad's family got partitioned. And got, you know, he was literally like they had broken the train tracks in between India and then what was what became Pakistan. He wasn't even from there. They were Arabs, but they had basically moved because there was no work in the 30s. And he was a kid. And so, you know, by the 40s, he had to had to smuggle his family across the demilitarized zone, being shot at by the British. Like snipers basically using children as sport. And, you know, he ended up putting them in a warehouse. And this was, so what they don't tell you about partition was that you had Sikhs and Hindus pitted against Muslims because the British drew lines directly through towns for no other reason than to cause strife. Right. And they did cause strife. And so this was the time where, you know, Jews and Muslims, this is disgusting, but I'll tell you, Jews and Muslims are circumcised, Hindus aren't. And Sikhs aren't. So what they would do is if they didn't think that you were Sikh or Hindu, they'd pull your pants down. If they saw you're circumcised, they'd cut your throat. And this went on for months. I mean, over, I think 1.5 million people died. And there's no Spielberg film about this. There's no narrative about this. There's no talking about this. There's no talking about the genocide in Bosnia. There's no talking about the genocide in Syria. There's no talking about the genocide in Rwanda. Maybe it was like talking points for like 2 hot minutes. There's no talk about the genocide in Sudan. There's no talk about what's going on in Yemen. There's no talk about what's going on right now with the Rohingya. There's no talk about the Uyghur Muslims who are being murdered and cut open by the Chinese for their organs. But we're totally interested in PC special interest stuff, okay? Mm. So you know, these are kind of like the international problems that you have with this, but to get to why this is relevant to your point, the people who are Muslim who come here respect their Americanism tremendously. You're gonna find small groups that are kind of like, they're happy to live here and make money, but they're like, you know, I'm still pissed off and I wanna go back. And you got Yemeni people who do that. You got a couple of little ethnic groups that do that. But remember, American Muslims are like 77 different ethnic groups. And like, people are always telling me like, well, you know, why can't you speak for all the Muslims? I'm like, does one Jew speak for all the Jews? Does one Protestant speak for all the Protestants? Does one Catholic speak for all the Catholics? Then why the hell should one Muslim speak for all the Muslims when we are this diverse, when we're this tapestry, when we speak so many different languages, and in most cases, we don't necessarily look at each other the same way. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. I wrote an article about it, and I'll share it. It's on Medium, and it's saying that we're not a monolith, and I've got Debbie Al-Muntasser in there, and she's a Democrat, okay, and her family's all NYPD cops, and we don't agree politically. But we do agree about a lot of things, that we love this country and this is the only country we got, you know, this is ours, you know, this is what we love. But what you are going to find is you're going to find a diversity of perspective on that. And so I would tell you that, yeah, you know, 95% of Muslims will be like super cool and groovy and 5% will be a little angry. But I don't see any difference in that in between, you know, Jews who hate Israel, you know, and you got a bunch of those too now. And that's where it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it's definitely important for those two things to be separated, as well as for there to be an open door for, let's say, women to go about any job that they want to do. And you've, I think, definitely seen an improvement in that, not just in Saudi Arabia.
Look, Mohammed bin Salman, you have to understand the entirety of the Arab Muslim world follows what Saudi did, okay? And Mohammed bin Salman making these steps to I'm working on an article on this. I don't know when I'm going to publish it because everyone keeps screaming at each other and like they're not going to read my article on mihram. So this is mihram is male guardianship, and this goes back to family. Okay, this is all about family. If a woman is it's literally almost like being in the South. Like you would introduce a woman, and there would be name cards, and then there would be a chaperone. Right. This is still my culture today across a number of different cultures, different races, different ethnicities, different languages. But that's still the culture. It's still very protective. And it's seen as the patriarchy here, but you also have a completely different culture here. And people kind of refuse to look at that. And so MBS making these gigantic steps, and as someone of Saudi, you know, Saudi lineage, I think this is a huge move, and it's also what you would talk to saying modernizing, but I don't think it's modernizing. I think what it is that we need to balance the cultural differences in between East and West in a manner and fashion that doesn't whitewash our religion, but also allows for a freedom of movement and of ideas and inclusion along the lines that, you know, are standard between men and women. Now, and some of the other stuff, yeah, we're going to have to discuss it, you know, because ecumenically close Christians and any ecumenically close Muslims have certain other perspectives and other persuasions.
I have a question about, I've been following somewhat superficially, there's chatter about Qatari influence and Saudi influence, like not only in the Muslim world, but in American culture or in like other
so the issue that you have is we talk about this group called Ihlan, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood grew out of pan-Arabism in the 1950s, and what the Muslim Brotherhood has become is part political organization, part politicians, and part social security / I would call it like WIC or food service programs in some countries, because you don't have any of that stuff, right? And so they provide all of these weird things. And so unraveling a group like that becomes very complicated. And so then what you've got is you've got some of these Ihlan, these Muslim Brotherhood guys in Qatar. And the Qataris are basically spending their lobbying money. I mean, people had in America had complained about Israel spending their lobbying money. Well, now the Qataris are doing the same thing. And what they're doing is they're pushing agendas that I don't think are very Western. And I think that kind of stuff should be slapped down. I think any of the Islamist stuff should be slapped down.
Which agendas? Is that through the Brookings Institute?
Yeah, there's probably, we'd have to pull up a whole bunch of things to have this discussion. But the general perspective of it is that they're pushing, remember when you were talking about like Sharia versus tribal law, right? So you that sort of thing. So that's called wali in Arabic. And so what we have the Qataris pushing is more of the tribal law aspects of this. One of the things that they had pushed was they said that FGM is okay. And I personally think anyone that says FGM is okay should be punched in the mouth.
What's FGM?
Female genital mutilation.
Ah.
Female circumcision, removing the clitoris. Mm. Typically with a sharp rock. And I was part of America Matters anti-FGM, you know, like council for about a year or two. And, you know, we try to raise awareness on this issue, but you can only do so much around these things. And I'm focused locally in Harlem, and, you know, I'm focused in some interfaith stuff. And I think that's what I can be successful at here.
Are you familiar with Mike Cernovich's film Blood Money?
Are you familiar with Mike Cernovich's film Silenced?
I'm not, actually.
I am in Mike Cernovich's film Silenced.
Oh, is that coming out soon?
Or that's, that's been out for like 2-3 years.
All right, that's gonna be.
Well, we have some homework. We have homework.
I'm friends with Mike.
Excellent. Incredible. We got to meet him one time recently. Cool guy.
Mike, you know, here's the thing about Mike. You might not like his politics and you might not like him as a person, but he is trying to tell people what is real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's on the opposite side of this. You got Bill Pulte, who's, you know, trying to become the Twitter philanthropist and change the way we're doing philanthropy. But Cernovich was the one that, that's the green room. Cernovich is the one who spent $20,000 of his own money to go after Epstein. And that's really the only reason that Southern District was forced to prosecute the guy. And we're going after all of these child molesters and pedophiles now. So you got to give the guy at least 2 cents worth of credit, whether you like him or not.
Absolutely.
But as far as the blood money thing, where do you want to go with this?
Well, it was a while since I saw it, but it seemed like they were talking about power dynamics in the Muslim world and how Saudi, like, and Saudi versus Qatari influence. And
the big problem is that Saudi has the same way that Israel has to balance in between the Likudniks and the lefties, right? So they balance them between the right and the left, and you have ultra orthodox people who are paying money to build settlements, paying money to demolish the houses of Palestinians. The problem that we have is that we have these Wahhabi guys that are paying money to put to basically sell a very not orthodox, but like completely Wali based strict version of Islam. So it's very tribal law strict in terms of how they're pushing this stuff. And the problem is that they've spent their money training people in the Philippines. I'm friends with a Bangsamoro princess. And I don't know if you remember this, but ISIS was in the Philippines a couple of years ago. And there were these two brothers that were in the South. Well, she was talking to me on Facebook probably about every other day, giving me updates on what was going on and, like, you know, where they were losing control of land. And they finally killed the two brothers because ISIS came in, and ISIS went to you have to think about what ISIS is. ISIS is the venture capital group of terrorism in the world, because what they've decided is that they have tons of Bitcoin, and what they can do, because that's how they got Bitcoin when it was cheap, and they were paying bills and things with it. And so what they can do now is they can utilize Bitcoin and cash to go find a dissident group. Like, this is what we had happen in Dhaka in Bangladesh, was they found a dissident group who was just very upset, and they paid them a bunch of money. And the next thing you know, they're singing the goddamn ISIS song, which itself is its own meme and its own subculture just around the song, people who don't even support ISIS. But they're singing the ISIS song, and they're carrying out bombings. Okay. And this is the challenge. This is the laughing man challenge of what we're dealing with in the future, is that people will find new weird motivations by which to get involved in terrorism. And we have to actually change not just all of our standard operating procedures, but we have to change the way that we understand terrorism and how we're engaging this terrorism. And it's not just Islamist, or I would even call it Islamic cult terrorism, because these are cults, okay? They have these are the branch Davidians of Islam. They have weaponized the religion, and they've taken all the meaning and the love out of it. But now we have Antifa, and we have these left extremists. And then on the opposite side of this, we have white supremacists. And the white supremacists are kind of, and I've talked to a bunch of them.
Who are some of the ones you've talked to?
I can't mention that. But they wouldn't want to be outed. But this was, you know, I've done AMAs on Donald before. And it was really more about talking about counterterrorism policy. And this is before the Donald was shut down. And I ended up talking to a bunch of these guys on Reddit. And some of them I talked to on the phone. And what's interesting is their perspective that then gets weaponized is, so I think you have a line of people that become betas and become incels, but then you have these other people that become alphas, and they're just afraid. And what they see is they see a culture that's very politically correct, that, you know, well, the white man is wrong, that they can't get education, they can't do this, they can't do that. America still has the come up. It's just the come up has changed, and you got to educate yourself a little bit. You have to educate yourself differently. But the opportunities, I think, are 10 times now what they were when I graduated high school. But a lot of these guys don't see that.
Right.
And
go ahead. No.
And the reason I talk to them is because I profile everything.
Right, right. What do you think about Mohammed bin Salman's advocacy for the Chinese re-education camps, like where they're
he's playing a political game there. I mean, Vice President Pence is talking about putting sanctions on China. The Saudis can't necessarily move on that without our blessing. But I do think that once the American government puts sanctions on China, and we're going to hit them hard with sanctions now because they've been declared a currency manipulator. Like, look, it's not just about them.
That's interesting. But what I was asking was, what do you think about just the notion of re-education camps?
I think these are the most dangerous. These are the most dangerous ideas I've ever heard in my life. And going to Lev, I don't know if you read this book, but it goes back to a book written in 1907 or 1914 by a Russian named Yevgeny Zamanyatin called W. And that was the book that actually gave George Orwell the idea to write 1984.
Fascinating. I haven't heard of this, but I'm definitely going to read it now.
So you don't like bin Salman's advocacy for the re-education camps?
He's not saying don't do them. And that's a problem. See, here's the thing. Muslims are caught in this weird place right now that white people are being forced into because of this whole white supremacy issue, where on the one side we can watch our people who are our own religion being murdered, and we have to very delicately comment on things like re-education camps, which are just basically, you know, brutalize them until they submit, otherwise fucking organ harvest them, and dealing with terrorism, because we're caught in this catch 22 in between the two areas. You want to speak against terrorism. China is saying this is against terrorism, but what China is actually doing is something else. But you're a king and you're a prince, heir apparent, you're the head of state, so you have to be very judicious in how you address these things. And that's what you'll find with most Muslims, is that they'll kind of give you very sort of calculated statements about a lot of things, because we're in the middle of this. I mean, I'm someone who actually went and just got fed up one day because actually, one of the catalysts to me getting really involved in all this anti-terrorism stuff was this was after one of the French attacks, and I was on a date, and I was sitting at dinner, and she frigging blamed me for the French attacks, and this is, you know, we're talking about a very liberal, Ivy educated woman who was blaming me for the attacks. And I was like, look, if this is the problem, then we have to do something about this. So, you know, I'm out there.
How is she blaming you? How?
Because I'm Muslim and I should have done something about this. These are my people, so obviously it's my fault. It's kind of like, you know, that blanket condemnation of the Jews that people do. And now we're getting it. Mm-hmm.
It's so foreign to me because I see it on the internet, or I read about it, or, you know, I see it on television, but it's just... I've never yet encountered, and I, maybe I'm blessed because I'm not.
You're blessed.
I do want to do what I can to help solve these problems and elevate dialogue. And, you know, because I'm very optimistic for the future. I think we have technological innovations coming around the corner.
I'm super optimistic. And
life extension, I think, is a potential reality. That a lot of people underestimate. And if we could focus on problems that we could solve together, it's like, let's say, like, I think one of the best ways to like overcome conflict is when you all have like a similar problem to solve together. Like if we saw a meteor like coming at us in slow motion and was about to like explode on the planet, like we'd all be able to communicate and cooperate and avert the meteor, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like people are very good at avoiding a slow moving disaster. And I think that the additional hope of technological innovation and life extension is something that everybody could potentially get behind, but only if they really start to think about economy of scale and how this progress happens and it doesn't create like its own kind of powder keg of like this new caste system, like an Elysium sort of divide, and that could create its own powder keg. But, you know, these are why, this is why conversations are so important. I heard a story once about there was a terrorist event in Russia, and was it a couple of Muslims took over a theater or took over a school?
No, it was a school you're talking about. It's let's separate a couple of Muslims, okay? Because this is like calling every Christian the IRA.
Okay,
this is literally where we are. Is like they're like, oh, it was Muslims.
Extremists.
Like,
no, you're right. I want to be sensitive with my language. So some extremists. No,
don't be sensitive with your language. Just be specific. They were Chechens. Okay, so there were a number of Chechens that took over a school and held the kids hostage and then started executing the kids. And so what happened was a fucking massacre, because the FSB ended up sending in the Spetsnaz, which is the Russian special forces, and they raided the school, and it turned into a firefight, and the kids got caught in the middle. And then on video, you had parents carrying their dead kids out of the school.
It's horrible.
It was atrocious.
My understanding was that the Russians, they buried all the dead militants with like pig corpses and stuff like that.
Insult. It's a statement to insult. I mean, like, listen, it could be pop culture.
The logic was that. Because they imagined they were true believers, they couldn't go to heaven. So it'd be kind of like,
look, I'm Muslim, and I'm
burying, you know, dead soldiers with pig corpses as a way to ensure
that you're still, none of those guys were going to heaven anyways. But I will tell you that, that it doesn't matter, you know, because at the end of the day, you're dead. And, you know, the Quran and even the Sunnah, which is the Hadith and everything else, is just talking about putting you back to the ground. You just return back to God. So, you know, the vessel that you're in doesn't mean anything anymore.
But do you think that's a controversial thing? Like, I could imagine a liberal...
Burying someone with a pig is totally controversial, but you have to understand they're dead. They're doing this to make a point that if you are a Chechen and you do this and you die, we will desecrate your body. That's what they're saying. You got to read between the lines with the Russians, because Russians are always playing chess.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Take it as a compliment. And you guys are crafty, I'll tell you that much.
Well,
that's why, you know, we came up with the nuclear bomb, and there's some guy smoking like two cigarettes. He's like, I told the guy I'm gonna make it in a garbage can. And that's
Well, no, the one thing that I would say about nuclear bomb creation is that in the Soviet Union, when they were trying to develop the scientists, like, they were given loads of caviar, alcohol, whatever the hell they wanted. But I really think that living under such an oppressive atmosphere as Stalin's Russia may have contributed something to these scientists not being able to do that good of a job. Like,
well, you got to remember that Stalin's Russia thought that, like, you could the whole premise is I think that the simplest thing was that you could freeze seeds and then like bury them in soil that wasn't necessarily responsive to germination. They should germinate. So I think a lot of what you ended up with was science's political dictate. And I think that's the problem we're running into in America today, is that we're running into academia as social construct dictate. And a lot of that's coming from the left. And I think, like, look, you know, America is one of these places where you should have open ideas. If you want to have a selected gender, because remember, this stuff has been ongoing with us for about a decade and a half. People are like all mad about this, you know, like gender specificity stuff. Of course we have binary genders, male and female, but people forget the fact that, like, in 2011, we had this subsect of lesbianism called boys, which was spelled BOIS. And these were women who were having double mastectomies to look like little boys. I mean, cyberpunk is really what all this stuff is, okay? All of this selected gender stuff is all cyberpunk, because the next thing that is going to happen from here is, you know, they're trying to be overly inclusive by including people like... in India, they have these men that, like, you know, kind of like lacerate or try to cut off their genitals and dress up as women called asnas, and so that's like a recognized gender by the state of New York right now. I say, if you want, this is America, if you want to do it, do it, do you, be whatever you want to be, just do it, you know, but don't force it on other people. Don't
not forcing it on other people, but there's also this almost elevation of the class of people that would do things like that, that they are like the samurais in ancient Japan, that they are beyond criticism. And I think that blames people.
What you eat and your sexual preference do not define you as a person. What defines you is the character of your soul and the good that you can do for people. Mm. Those are the only two things that should define you. And maybe your achievements, you know, because a lot of people, like, you look at your crypto billionaires and their stupid Lambos. I mean, it's their achievements. But then you look at you look at people that are doing like a lot of crypto social good. And you know, I joined the board of PacCoin, right? And I think the big thing that we could be doing by rolling out paper wallets and identity solutions and a lot of these things with a coin that has a built-in tithing system, which could be like the social security of the future for who knows what, when, where, is that, like, it's just kind of, you know, like Jules just said, we're living in the most exciting time I think we've ever lived in our entire lives. We've got a move, you know, the socialists are trying to move us out of capitalism. Everyone's trying to keep us in capitalism. I personally think that we're moving into a new capitalistic paradigm that's based upon the utilization of data and other points as actual assets. And this is going to get real interesting. And I think we're moving into kind of like a techno-economic construct, right? We've got these social constructs that are changing our perceptions of normative reality in terms of gender. They can totally do that, but they got to leave us men and women alone. Like, we want to be men and women, let us be men and women. You want to do all that? Give us a chart every 6 months to update us on where you are with this. And we'll be super cool about just talking to you how you want to be talked about. But you got to friggin' educate people. You cannot just get mad because you just didn't tell them and they didn't get, I'm like, I didn't get the memo. I need a memo. All right. And then, because we're all generally cool about this. I'm like, I'm super supportive. I have friends who are trans and I'm like super supportive of them. I'm like, just do you, you know, but it's just, I don't necessarily care. And then I think on the third aspect of this is that we need to be focusing on the environment in a way that it makes sense. Mm-hmm. The reason that the right is totally against the Green New Deal is because it's kind of like saying, I'm going to Vegas with your credit card. And no one has any idea what the plans are or what it costs. And this was the same problem with the Paris Accord, was that America was paying for everything, yet China has no reason to cut back their pollution. We pulled out of the Paris Accord and Trump, like, has just hampered them and has hammered them economically. Oh, they're starting to clean stuff up because they're realizing that people don't want to buy all that stuff. And at the same time, they're poisoning their people to death. China puts out more pollutants. They have more ppm in the air, parts per million in the air, than America and Europe combined.
Mm-hmm. My problem with the Green New Deal is I feel like it's designed to create an elite insider class.
Yeah, all of the problems that we have. It's like, look, if you want to look at liberal communism and liberal socialism and even liberalism, called traditional modern liberalism, it creates a class of have and have nots. And the have nots are my constituents living in Harlem. Okay. But we've got 35, 40 years worth of food stamps and projects. They have literally, they're running in between multiple offices to just make sure that they can make ends meet. They don't know that there's a ceiling right above them. This artificial ceiling, that if they were to go and get job training, skill training for 12 months to be anything outside of an RN, an MTA worker, or a cleaning lady, that they could move into technology jobs. They could start management training jobs. They could do all these different things. They could go from making $12 an hour to $20 an hour. But this is literally something they do not know. The knowledge of a high schooler coming out of the suburbs in terms of what their job opportunities are is 1,000 times more powerful than the knowledge of someone graduating from one of the high schools in my district. Mm. And this is what the Green New Deal perpetuates.
How much do you think this can be solved with just some kind of outreach or rebuilding the family?
I think the family is the most important thing in America. And I don't care what kind of family that is. You want to have a gay family, have a gay family. You want to have a straight family, have a straight family. Just have a goddamn family, okay? Have a family unit and have a way by which you can talk to other people and that you can nurture and you can build the lives of the children in front of you. For far too long, we have had this focus in America on, you know, the glamorization of single mothers. And I will tell you, there's a lot of single mothers that I know that, you know, they're struggling. They're struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling. And the other thing is that, you know, there's a necessity to have two people guiding a child. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's male and female energy from my religious perspective, from my cultural perspective, from my ethnic perspective. Everyone else can have their own different perspective, but I think you need to allow everyone their different perspectives on this, and you cannot chastise them for having that perspective. Right.
Absolutely.
But I think those things are very important to just the baseline of us relating to each other. Okay. Because we find these commonalities in our communities, and we build communities around families. What you find more and more in New York is with these post-religious, post-secular, post-identity communities, no one talks to each other.
Well, you know, there used to be a lot more charitable organizations, like fraternal organizations, used to meet up and talk about how they could help in the community.
And, I'm in a bunch of them, and I'm telling you, they're aging out. Mm-hmm. You know, the mean age of Masons is like 62. The mean age of the Elks Club is like 60. The mean age of, you know, a lot of these organizations, these fraternal organizations, is very old, and they're not getting new people in. We need something new. We need new clubs. We need new ways. We need new methods. Right? I mean, remember that art, what was that art club that we went to for that art opening?
Well, I got some news for you. That's the National Arts Club, and yeah. I am now the chair of the Art and Technology Committee there.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, so I met you at NAC, and I'm going to get chastised for not remembering it was NAC. And it was your father's paintings, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, like, just think about, like, the things that, like, we have engaged in and met on common grounds in New Yorkers, and we are such different people. We don't even, you know, we were different religiously, we're different ethnically, we're different politically, but we find common ground on these things. Mm-hmm. And we find things to be excited about, you know?
Like, well, that's what I'm trying to do with the National Arts Club as well. I want to start bringing more people in there who are interested in a lot of the issues that we're talking about right now, turning it partly into a modern day bacchanalia. That was the
if you want to do something where we get Democrats and Republicans to talk to each other, I am all on board.
Absolutely. That's
I'm so on board for that.
That's definitely
Lev has introduced me to this extremely online community, which I think there are some parallels to the article you wrote about with online extremism, or like the model of the laughing man. Like, all this stuff was a blind spot of mine until I met Lev, and there's this extremely online community that Lev wants to introduce to the National Arts Club. Some of them are authors and things like that. I wonder, so I think some of them are more in touch with meme culture than others.
Oh yeah,
like internet culture. Are you familiar with the internet, the viral internet meme of like nerds rewrote the Quran in Klingon?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I thought that was pretty cute or pretty funny. But I was trying to figure out, like, what's your perspective on that mimetic?
Well, I kind of think this way, you know, the Quran can be translated into any language, just as long as you take some time to try and understand the meaning of it in the original language. And I will tell you that the best thing to look at is, if you go on Amazon, there's a new version that came out. It's the Quran with Bible citations, and it was a 20-year project. And it's literally cross-referenced. And I think if you want to try and understand the religion in the context of Christianity, it's the best place to start. But listen, some of this stuff is fanzine. Some of this stuff is memezine. Some of this stuff is subculture. And that, I mean, is like, that's that in of itself is a freaking layered meme.
Right. Are you familiar with the Dutch lawyer who was, he was like an extreme anti-Muslim radical or something? I'm butchering this, but he was.
Are you talking about the guy who became Muslim?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that was real funny. We were laughing about that one, but like, look, that, it happens. It's also happened. So
he was like extreme anti-Muslim, and then he converted to Islam. And my understanding of that was because
he was the mayor of Rotterdam. No, sorry, the mayor of Rotterdam is Muslim. He was like a local politician. But that happened. But what's your question?
My understanding is because his, I could be butchering this again, but his perspective was that Islam is a military doctrine, and he thought it was designed to be a supremacist.
This is so dumb. These are these people that say that they ignore the history, they ignore the liturgy, they ignore 1,000 years of liturgical science, they ignore the fact that it's not Sharia, it's fiqh, it's Islamic jurisprudence. They ignore the fact that the only pieces of Sharia that people care about are marriage, cutting their meat, getting divorced, and how they slice up, you know, things after someone dies, or how they buy and finance their house. The rest of this stuff doesn't necessarily matter to people.
But they have isn't convert or die in the Quran? A convert or die doctrine?
No, you then have to look at how the religion is practiced, and that's through the schools of thought. Mm-hmm. And there's 1,000 years of liturgical science, and I can actually bring, if you want to do this again, I'll bring my buddy Gareth, who's a Muslim imam, but he's also a chaplain, he's a certified New York chaplain, and we can kind of take some of these pieces apart.
This is all really interesting, really interesting stuff. I'm a bit of a perennialist when it comes to believing that a lot of the different things that the religions discuss, there is sort of an impressionist painting that I end up drawing inside of my head. And I think in Freemasonry, we also see those similar kind of patterns in the Kabbalah Tree of Life, in esoteric Hinduism, and all these things. I do see some kind of a pattern forming as far as there being a hierarchy of consciousness.
Look, Islam is a very scientific religion. It's mathematically based. If you go into the mosques in Turkmenistan, all of the designs are made in linear algebra, and they only figured that out a couple of years ago. Okay. It is a religion of science first and foremost. What we get chastised on is a whole bunch of armchair readers that'll read like half of a book. They'll decide we're violent, and they'll tell me I'm violent. Or my main favorite one is this. These people who go and dig up the word tahiyya. So tahiyya is a Shia concept that was originally to hide themselves in the case of war or sometime like this. And it means that you could fabricate things. Now, there's some very small instances where it's been used by Sunnis, but I had to look it up. And I've been a practicing Muslim all my life, and my dad was a sheikh who ministered to 5 different Muslim communities and did the funerals for the Shia community because they didn't have an imam. Okay? My dad's a sheikh. That's like a bishop. Mm-hmm. And in my entire 45 years of living, I heard this maybe when I was 35. In 35 years, I had never heard the word tahiyya. Okay? Then all of a sudden, they're like, you're doing takoya. And I'm like... what? And I had to go look this up. And then I'm looking this up and I'm like, this is a Shia concept. So, you know, now what you have is people yelling at us about Shia concepts and we're Sunni. And so that's like yelling at Protestants about taking communion.
From what I was able to get of a lot of perspective of people who are generally fearful of things that, as we talked about today, there may not be any need to be fearful of. If I can cement it in one simple example, from my own Russian culture, it would be the relationship that Russians, a majority of whom descended from serfdom, and I think are still stuck in that kind of mentality, show towards their President Putin, which is one of looking towards this very charismatic, big daddy type of figure to tell them what to do. What I don't want to have happen, either in the Muslim community or in any community, is for there to be some kind of a charismatic figure that can rise up, and then people who are on the sidelines, who are otherwise completely peaceful and friendly, would feel a peer pressure in order to succumb to
something. I don't think that's how that dynamic would work, to be honest. I feel like that'd be more of a right wing or left wing.
That would actually be more left wing than right wing, but it could also be right wing. Muslims are a fully decentralized religion. Yeah. Okay, we're like the blockchain. We have local sheikhs usually. We have our schools of thought. But you know, this monolith perspective that people have is completely misguided. It's uneducated, and you know what we need to do is it's conversations like this that allow us to start breaking these fake walls down. But to understand that like I as a Sunni Hanafi Saudi and Mughal person will believe something different than someone who's Iraqi and Sunni, someone who's Iraqi and Shia, someone who's Indian and Sunni, someone, you know, but we may have similar precepts of what the baseline of our religious faith is, our praxis, our specific ideologies and our specific notions towards things may be different.
Praxis. I love that word, praxis. I thought that was a postmodern word. But
no, they just start taking everything. They're taking all the words.
What are your thoughts on Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz?
Majid is weak. I mean, like I've watched a lot of his stuff, and I was gonna write an article on one of his, you know, one of these things he put out. I think he's interesting, you know, from the counter radicalization perspective. I just don't think he's effective, and I just don't think he gets Gen X, millennials, or Gen Z, and he definitely doesn't get Americans.
But do you think the path of former radical to then like a 180 turn, you think that's not?
I think it's fantastic. I just don't know if he's effective.
But leading by example, isn't that effective?
Can be. But you have to ask something. Inside of this meme culture we live in, do people care?
Why wouldn't they care?
Because you live in an apathetic world of people who have practically everything they generally need, so that we're dealing largely in the Western world and now sometimes in the GCC with, you know, depression issues, meme culture. It's very postmodern. And so I think that
you think that he's kind of meh.
And
Sam Harris, you think
Sam's think okay. I think I'm starting to read some of his stuff, but I don't know enough about Sam Harris to comment. I just started reading his stuff last week.
You think he's an alarmist about, like...
Give me a specific point to comment on it, because
I'm pretty sure he would say that Islam is a military doctrine, and that...
Then I would say Sam Harris is an idiot who needs to actually do a lot more research. Because there's nothing military about this religion. This religion is mathematical. This religion is logical. This religion has a lot of impassioned people that practice based on wali, which is tribal law, versus what they're supposed to be practicing and based upon Islamic madhab school of thought, you know, and whatever their sects are. And then there's also the fact that inside of all this new postmodernism, people are just kind of creating whatever they want outside of this. And there's clear definitions of what is Islam and what isn't Islam that come from an Islamic perspective that we have to educate people on, separate podcast. And then there's cults like ISIS, which are not Islam, which we think are just virulent, you know, nasty things. They're Islamists who are trying to take political Islam, and we're all necessarily worried about those. And there's people who are looking at the revival, which is like, how do we get people back to faith a little bit and just, you know, less material focus. And then you have reformers like, you know, Shireen and Zudi and that sort of thing.
Well, before you were talking about Wahhabism, how it infuses a lot of these tribal customs into Islam. Is that correct?
It's what they look at is they're looking at religion tribally, and that's what Wahhabism is. Okay. And Wahhabism was really kind of a under King Faisal. I mean, this is going back a bit.
Is he even from Kuwait?
No, that was Saudi.
we're going back 40, 50 years here. The Wahhabis basically consolidated some of the ecumenical power in Saudi because it allowed for the Saudi king to build his base by putting together all of the tribes in Saudi. And this was originally done by the original king in the 20s and 30s, but it had to be done again in the 40s and 50s. And that's why you had the rise of Wahhabism, because most Saudis are humbly, but they're not Wahhabi. But then you have the Wahhabis, which have basically, you know, created schools and brought Filipinos in and paid to train them and that sort of thing. And they're very narrow in their thinking. And, you know, everyone looks at everything as a problem. And I think we need a better understanding in the West of what the different tapestry of these religious perspectives is, and how it is relatable from different understandings of either Christianity or Judaism, and where the metaphors lie.
Well, if you were to ask somebody who was a Wahhabi, are you a true Muslim? Are you practicing true Islam? Would they say yes?
What is true Islam? Because literally that sounds like an advertising tagline for the Ahmadis. The Ahmadis are walking around saying, we're true Islam. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It's like, true Islam is the closest that you have to the practice that the Prophet had basically espoused, which was nonviolence, which was a lot of take care of your neighbor, build your community, take care of your family first, you know, those types of things. I can't answer that question because it's a silly question.
But they would consider themselves to be the real deal. Like they wouldn't.
They would consider themselves to be Muslims. I don't. What exactly does true Islam mean?
Yeah, that sounds like a no true Scotsman fallacy, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, that's a good point. The only reason why I bring it up is that if there was a movement like that that would come up again with another Muhammad al-Wahhab, I just don't know how exactly people would react to something like that. Like, would they?
You're unlikely to find that in this day and age. I mean, one of the things I think that you should look at is the creators of Ananas. If there's another one, there's a blockchain startup that's allowing people to fully document what their sect is and attach all the books and attach all the documentation and this and that. These are the things that we kind of need into the future because, you know, you're getting a diversity of thought, because in Islam, there's many, many, many sects. There's multiple madhabs. There's different perspectives of view. There are some that have problems and there's some that are cults that should be condemned. And then there's the Islamists who should just be smacked on the head. But all of this exists, and a lot of this exists because of colonialism. A lot of this exists because of wars, and a lot of this exists because you have different countries with different hegemonic aims. And inside of that, you have people who are evolving. Very much like, you know, what we've seen in Judaism, where you had Orthodox for a very long period of time, then it was Orthodox and Reform, and then Orthodox, Conservadox, Reform, and Liberal, right? And then now you have these new Jews who are maybe, I guess I'd call them high holiday Jews only, right? We're running into some things like that in Islam, but in Islam, we don't have those delineations. We have practicing, non-practicing, or secular. That's all we have. I'm practicing.
Well, it's definitely important that you're doing what you're doing right now and that we're all talking. Because if we're going to be in our little ideological bubbles and not be able to have this conversation, like I think a lot of people who are in these liberal elite establishments are talking about censoring 4chan. They recently took down 8chan, and I think that is the complete antithesis of what we want.
Look, if you censor everywhere that everyone can speak, they're going to go in the dark web. And the laughing men I'm talking about, when they come out, trust me, they're not going to come with a gun. They'll come with a bazooka. And that's the stuff we got to worry about.